Hey everyone, and welcome back to the SaaS Developer Community, where we discuss interesting topics around building SaaS. And today I have with me Adam Sugar. Adam is the co-founder and CTO of a very new startup called Dash Dive, and he's helping SaaS companies with literally the worst problem, which is analyzing and optimizing our cloud costs. I'm so happy to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Gwen.
Fantastic. So you shared with me when we prepared for this session the story of how you got to start this particular company with this particular mission. And I thought it's the best story ever. Can you share that?
Sure. I guess I can start from the beginning. So as you noted when we were talking earlier, we are sort of fresh out of school. We graduated college in 2022, my co-founder, Micah, and I. And we started by working on a social app, you know, as 22-year-olds often do. And, you know, we were having some trouble with traction and just generally wanted some more guidance. We applied to Y Combinator, got in with that sort of social app idea. And very quickly, you know, they told us, we think you should pivot. We sort of obstinately stuck it out for a couple more months, but eventually realized they were pretty much right. And, you know, transitioned over to B2B sort of SaaS, which is definitely Y Combinator's kind of strength. And also, you know, we felt it would be nice to have people who actually are straight up and tell you their needs, and then you can go build exactly what they need. So we started doing interviews with a lot of software engineers, and as well as more senior kind of engineering managers, you know, bouncing various ideas off of them. And this was kind of during the big contraction. This was, we were in winter 23. So, you know, everyone was kind of tightening their belts, and the fundraising market was drying up initially. And the thing we kept hearing over and over is that, you know, people didn't really understand their costs. Cost of capital was increasing. They wanted to increase their margins for their next fundraising round. And, you know, in bigger companies, this kind of manifested as, you know, we don't know how to have cost accountability for our managers. You know, each team is sharing the same resources. And, you know, I don't know how to evaluate my managers. Like, it's easy for me to see revenue for this product, for this team, but it's harder to see cost and harder to enforce accountability for that. And in smaller sort of startup scenarios, it's pretty much per customer. You know, you're doing custom things in SaaS for each customer, and you don't necessarily know what features are driving the cost. And so that's sort of how we landed on this problem. And luckily, you know, there's a startup use case, which made it way easier to kind of enter the market. You know, early startups are a lot more willing to take a leap of faith with a new idea and a new company like ours. So that's where we started. And then we started working with a design partner, a security camera company, to help monitor their S3 usage. And S3, if you're using the same bucket for a lot of customers, is sort of almost inherently multi-tenant. So you sort of need observability tooling applied to each bucket to understand, like, you know, how much storage is allotted to each customer, you know, how much data egress is allotted to each customer, unless you're extremely disciplined about, you know, prefixing everything properly. And even then it's sometimes hard. So that's kind of how we got to where we are. Yeah.
And as you kind of hinted, you're taking a very interesting approach to the entire cost problem. You're treating it as an observability concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So that's sort of the gap that we identified in the cloud cost, sort of cutting cloud cost understanding market. And honestly, our product is not the best use case for everything. So, you know, for example, there are plenty of cloud cost tools already on the market that essentially ingest your AWS cost and usage report bills, you know, so at the end of the month, you get, you know, per database, per region, per EC2, et cetera. And these tools ingest it, show it in a much nicer dashboard, build a lot of like very nifty features on top. You know, as we talked about, there are billions of dollars to be made just on the fact that AWS's UI could use a lot of improvements, right? So, you know, these cloud cost kind of dashboards do an important job in, you know, adding alerting on top of all that. But where they really fall short is in sub-resource attribution. So in a lot of companies, both big and small, you know, say you use the same very large Postgres database to serve all of your customers, or you use the same Kubernetes cluster for many customers. And, you know, even down to the individual pod level, the same pod is serving API traffic for like all your different customers, many customers. So even if you were to tag that pod or that database with like every single customer or one customer, you don't get an accurate breakdown because just dividing by the number of customers doesn't really tell you if there's like some outsized usage or some inefficiency that you need to like find and correct. So that's sort of the difference is we use agents and agentless monitoring to collect per event usage. So in S3, that's like per object put, per object get. We collect all of it in a database. It might be a select query, an insert query, and in Kubernetes, it really depends. With compute, it depends a lot on the use case. So a cron job or a batch job might be monitored very differently than like a high throughput HTTP server. But for example, with an HTTP server running on Kubernetes, it might be like per API request, try to attribute the CPU and memory usage to that very specific, very small request. And then we kind of roll that up over a very large number of requests, a lot of activity into a kind of BI dashboard that then shows you your usage and the calculated cost based on the cloud provider's billing rules.
And the benefits of treating the problem as an observability problem is that you get a lot more slicing and dicing flexibility and drilling into details that may be really hard to get out of the AWS Cost Explorer.
Exactly. And it certainly only applies to some customers. Not every customer has the ideal fit for something like this. For example, if you have single tenant infrastructure, if you spin up entirely new infrastructure for every single customer or like run it in their cloud, for example, then there's really no use for what we're providing. And the existing cloud cost tools are quite sufficient. So,
well, there's also, you mentioned earlier, the accountability of engineering manager. Sure.
Yeah.
Use case, which was also back at Confluent. I had my team. I had to report cost savings every single quarter. I was looking for projects that would allow my team to report those cost savings. Mm-hmm. And it's not always easy to even find meaningful opportunities to save cost, even if as a manager, you have the incentives and the ability to do it.
Totally. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So obviously observability is kind of a technically hard problem. Can you guys share your tech stack? How you built it? What's your approach?
Yeah. So we kind of had to, the standard YC advice is do things that don't scale. And that's certainly true in some respects for us. But unfortunately, we had to do the sort of the scalable things somewhat out of the gate because the first customer that we were working with was very high scale. We started with S3 specifically. So they're storing, petabytes of video in Amazon's S3 cloud, as well as other S3 providers, and doing a lot of API requests, a lot of data throughput. And so that basically meant that we had to use like an OLAP kind of analytics stack rather than like a more like transactional database row oriented stack. So we use ClickHouse and Kafka and Kubernetes. And so on the beginning of the sort of ingestion pipeline, we have highly replicated Kubernetes nodes with sort of ingest services. So we have an endpoint like an S3 event ingestion endpoint where the client sends usage events that happened in S3 in very high volumes. And then these highly replicated nodes basically confirm, the authentication and kind of transform the event to be ingested into ClickHouse in the backend. They write it to Kafka, both as sort of a back pressure and kind of like queuing mechanism, as well as, just to replicate it. And then from Kafka, it's ingested into ClickHouse. And then finally, the sort of BI tool dashboard from the other side reads from ClickHouse. So we do a lot of like pre-aggregation, manual aggregations as well, some joins for the more complicated, stateful stuff that can't just be done with regular materialized views. We show that in the dashboard in real time.
Got it. And honestly, for an architecture that scales, it doesn't sound quite that complicated either.
Yeah, for now. I mean, we'll see how well it scales, but it seems to be working well.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you have those collectors for S3 and getting data out of all those systems. Do you use anything like open telemetry related? Like if I want to integrate with, I happen to have a database. If I want to integrate and send metrics in your direction, is it just about getting an endpoint and open telemetry exporter?
Yeah, so we kind of have two levels at which you can integrate right now. So we haven't built out any sort of OpenTelemetry integration purely because we don't have any customers who are using OpenTelemetry at the moment. But we love OpenTelemetry. I mean, we're really excited about it, and that's definitely on our roadmap to build out an integration. Because honestly, you know, as you sort of alluded to, one of the biggest challenges with integrating a product like ours is like high upfront cost. If you know, if you don't have any observability already instrumenting your application, then starting with us, it just takes real engineering effort. It's non-trivial. And so it helps a lot if you already have like a Honeycomb or OpenTelemetry or something like that, that you can just like transform and send to us. So that's definitely on the roadmap. The way it works now is customers can either install an agent or they can send to our API directly. And the customers we're working with currently all just send to our API directly. I mean, some people have concerns about security with running an agent or things like that. But we also sort of offer an eBPF enabled agent. So you just put it on every container or every EC2 instance that that you're running and want to instrument with Dashdive. And then with theoretically very little code change, we can sort of automatically collect usage events and then send those to the same API that the customers can manually send to. So
makes a lot of sense. You said you talked to a lot of customers to understand their problems. Did you get sense of the technologies that are popular? I know you're starting with S3, which is probably the most popular storage system in the world at the moment. But I'm wondering if there's anything else that stands out to you, like if some of our listeners are starting something right now and they want to use technologies that a lot of other SaaS companies are happy with, What would you recommend?
Yeah, well, I think what we've been seeing might not be super applicable to very early stage SaaS companies because this problem tends to manifest, you know, when you're past Series A, Series B. You know, for the earliest stages, everyone has their cloud credits, and frankly, they don't care very much about costs. I mean, even we don't with our current cloud credits, which is sort of ironic. But you know, for companies that are past Series B or something like this, the big one that we've seen and the next integration that we're working on currently is Kubernetes. Almost every company that we've talked to, whether it's like a high throughput kind of like HTTP server or API server companies or AI companies, even that are doing, you know, offline batch and model training, almost everyone is using Kubernetes. And for many of these companies, compute is like the vast majority of their cost. So I'd say learning Kubernetes is definitely a skill that is not going to put you, you know, out of the market anytime soon.
Yeah, it's interesting because Kubernetes used to be one of the things that definitely don't start with that. Mm-hmm. But from a bunch of interviews that I've been doing over the last 2 years, I don't think I've met anyone who did not start with that.
Wow, that's quite
maybe you know different because Y Combinator does give the do things that don't scale advice, but so maybe you have more stories of people who stayed away from Kubernetes.
Yeah, well, we have done a couple engagements with earlier stage startups, and we find that they are really interested in like avoiding platform engineering altogether, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's kind of the textbook definition of undifferentiated heavy lifting. And so often they will use ECS or even Fargate directly and just containerize their workloads to the extent that that's possible. I think the reason that there's a lot of, you know, we talked to some companies in like the oil and gas sector who actually one told us that they were even maxing out AWS's instance availability in certain regions to give you an idea of like the scale of compute that they're using. And so I think that, you know, once you get to that level and you need a lot of control over like the provisioning of resources, then it makes sense to use Kubernetes. But if you're just trying to get something off the ground, I mean, we've definitely seen people use Fargate and ECS plenty, or Google Cloud Run is kind of the analog as well.
I really appreciate you saying this because we got started with ECS and Fargate. Yeah. And after a while of everyone else talking about Kubernetes, you start thinking, am I doing something wrong?
Yeah, no, I think you're doing it right. I mean, I've run into plenty of Kubernetes headaches. You definitely don't want to use it if you're not absolutely sure that you have to. And the only reason we do is for the auto scaling capabilities and some of, yeah, some stuff like that.
So. Yeah, so you mentioned that you're part of a recent YC batch, and you already gave us one good tip out of Y Combinator. So I'm really curious, in what ways you felt that it was helpful for you, and if you have a few more tips to share with our listeners.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so Y Combinator was definitely transformative for us. I think that, you know, we wouldn't be here as a company without the Y Combinator experience that we had. The partners were like incredibly helpful with their advice, and it just, I think the biggest transformation, I mean, there were many things that it offered, but the biggest one for us was just structure. I mean, you know, as we talked about, we were straight out of school. We were doing a social app. We, you know, had a lot of energy, but basically had no idea what we were doing. And Y Combinator is really strong in its just hammering of simple advice that it is, you know, you do well to remember often. And so, you know, things like build the product, focus most of your time on writing code, talk to users and really listen to the problems they have. Don't build extraneous features. You know, don't play startup. Don't spend all your time going to networking events and, you know, doing things like that. And that was really helpful for us just to orient, you know, given the limited real world experience that we had, and just to be surrounded by a lot of other people in the batch. I mean, they do a great job community building and putting you in the same room with a lot of other, you know, really high energy people, and sort of commiserate, you know, who are going through the same things as you at that time and trying to build something. And so, yeah, that was sort of the best part of it for us, was just adding structure and giving us some sort of guidance.
Yeah. And it seems like some of those, this is a common mistake, everyone makes it, please do not make this one, is kind of a recurring theme of the experience.
Definitely. I will say, I think the earlier we are, the earlier we were, the more helpful it was for us. I think if we, you know, were to go have a go again in 5 or 10 years with a lot more experience and do another company, at least in the same sector, we might not get the same transformative experience. But I mean, that's just personally our experience. You know, the earlier you are, I think the more helpful the structure and the community can be. So
yeah. I'm also thinking that having the community can be helpful in cases where you actually know the right thing, but it's hard to get the willpower to do it. So one of the things that my experience was really hard, everyone always tells founders, launch before you're ready. If you're not embarrassed by your product, you're probably too late. Like, I heard it probably north of 100 times in the 2 years it took us to launch. It's a lot harder to actually ship a product you're embarrassed of than to know that you're supposed to do it. So I'm getting a sense that if you're a community of people and you get to talk about out and commiserate, you get a bit of the social pressure that may just get you to do this kind of thing.
Definitely. I that's a great point. I think at any stage, it helps to have just those hard reality checks from the group partners every week. You know, I mean, the culture there is sort of one of a kind. I mean, they'll tell you exactly what they're thinking. If they think you're doing a terrible job, they'll tell you that you're doing a terrible job and exactly why, which is actually really helpful, even if it doesn't sound great to hear. But yeah, to your point about community, I mean, we actually still meet every month with our small group kind of co-founders in other companies. There's about 10 companies, and we check in every month just because we found those meetings during the batch super helpful, and we set goals and you know, having that kind of social pressure of like, well, I said I was going to get that customer last month. I can't show up to this meeting empty-handed. Like, it really helps.
This is so, so true. And it's also, I think we're at a stage where we started having our early customers, and having them as a form of pressure is also so useful. Definitely. I have to get it done because I promised the customer it will be done by tomorrow. So this has to be done by tomorrow. No matter what happens, it has to get done. So you kind of set yourself up to a point where you don't want to disappoint other people, and therefore you kind of push extra. Mm-hmm. And hopefully customers are nicer, it sounds like, than your Y Combinator group. But you still feel like you don't want to disappoint them. You want to, and seeing them say something like, oh my God, you guys are so fast, how did you figure out this bug so fast? It is really cool.
Well, I mean, once we got really engaged with our first customers, our feature pace of development just went way up.
Yeah, they tell you, as you said in the beginning, they tell you what they need and you just have to go and build it. It's so much better.
That's right.
So we talk on the topic of good advice. A startup that, even though it's small, we still care about our margins. We definitely care about the unit of economics, because I feel like this is something that is hard to fix later if your entire unit economic is wrong. And in the words of Charity Measure, your startup is actually reselling AWS at a loss. This is not a good business model. And I think even if you're using cloud credits, you want to have a sustainable business model. What kind of advice do you have around optimizing cloud costs?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I, you know, when we were first starting on this path and hearing from engineering leaders about their cloud cost problems, we did a pretty comprehensive survey of the cloud cost market as it stood at the time. And it's still largely similar, to see if anyone was doing the sort of sub-resource attribution that we were focused on. And we didn't find anything, but we did learn a lot about the market. And broadly, by far the biggest class of companies that we talked about, discovered, or the ones that we talked about earlier, which are these sort of like AWS usage reports ingesting with better UI, as well as some alerting features on top of that. Many of these companies also have features where they sort of profess to use AI to automatically cut your costs a bit. How much they really use AI is up for debate, but they definitely use some heuristics to, you know, find exactly, you know, how many reserved instances you benefit from purchasing, and things like that. And so I'd kind of bucket it into two different kind of strategies, considerations, for early stage companies, even mid-market kind of companies. And one is sort of, okay, we just, our costs are way too high. We need to get them down. And we need to just do a first pass sanity check, because, you know, just from an entropy standpoint, like over time, if nobody's monitoring it, things are going to spin out of control. That tends to happen a lot. And so for something like that, those tools are really good. So they will flag, hey, you know, you're not using these EC2 instances, just shut them down on an ongoing basis. They'll tell you that. They'll tell you general trends in your entire kind of across many accounts. They're good for aggregation and rolling up across like GCP, AWS, many different accounts, many different environments, just giving you like bird's eye view trends of that and telling you if something is like seriously wrong, something that might have slipped through the cracks. Where we don't feel that they kind of succeed as much is in like real unit economics. Like, sure, you can kind of take your total cost for your production environment and divide it by the number of customers. And that's your like unit economics, so to speak. But you know, the problem is that doesn't account for various features being offered to different customers, one customer accounting for the lion's share of usage, as we've seen with some companies that we've talked to. And for that, you really need observability. And that's where, you know, something like Dashdive comes in, or, you know, some companies have talked about, well, maybe we can home roll this ourselves with OpenTelemetry, with, you know, Datadog, and just getting those usage metrics in there. And, you know, that's a reasonable proxy for costs if you assume, you know, the cloud providers aren't being too predatory. Really, the value proposition of Dashdive is kind of to take care of all the kind of cloud provider intricacies for you. So, you know, you can collect the usage data yourself pretty easily, but providing the right structure for each usage event and like, you know, codifying all the kind of Byzantine billing rules of the cloud provider for each service is not something you probably want to spend your time doing.
There is no way I can translate 50 API calls per second going through an API gateway to actual cost. There is so many different AWS components on the way. Every one of them has ingress costs, egress costs, the cost of the device, the cost of the usage of the like. It's seems almost impossible to do off top of your head, to be honest. So I don't think Datadog monitoring can help me at all. Like the raw numbers do not easily translate to costs. Maybe at S3 it's still doable, but the moment you have an like EC2 in front of it, and then it has a NAT, and then it's have the VPC, and you have ingress and egress, like it's.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I'm giving voice to some of the common objections we hear from engineers. Well, why can't I just build this myself? I mean, by all means.
There is no way. If anyone is listening to this and thinking they can do it themselves, I would almost say that I would like to quiz the person. I'll show my Datadog monitor. Tell me how much this costs, because there's just literally no way it can be done.
Yeah. So I guess just to summarize kind of to your question of like what kind of cloud cost cutting strategies should a company think about, and you know what kind of solutions are available on the market, there's sort of general first pass bird's eye view, like get a handle on everything. And some of these tools like Cloud Zero is a fairly mature one that's like sort of one of these cloud cost dashboards will work great for that. If you really wanted to optimize your margin in a customized way that goes beyond like, well, just buy some reserved instances, just, you know, right size your instances, then I think it can often be helpful to have observability data to say like, oh, in our specific case, this one feature is like really inefficient and people are using it a lot. And it's not sort of maybe even priced in. A lot of times we find that companies just are sort of shooting blind on their pricing and saying, well, this probably relates to usage. Let's charge on these features. But, you know, some customers might be getting a really good deal that you don't want. You know, your margins are too low. And there's no way to really know until you like look at the observability data. So
exactly that. The other thing I would give as my advice is to really find a way to keep your finger on the pulse on a weekly or even daily basis. Getting a surprise bill at the end of the month can be traumatic if you did not previously prepare for that. It was traumatizing for me to get some, like, why is this month 20 times more than the previous month? I did not do 20 times more. And also, I saw a lot of the customers I talked to and even people in the community saying things like, I can no longer use this vendor, even though I love them, because the surprise bill scared me off of them. So I moved to a vendor that actually costs me more in normal cases, just so I will not get hit with a surprise bill. Like, this is, especially for a small startup that is trying to calculate the runway, this is a very traumatic experience. So really having a system that will tell you, not a month later, oops, you spent 20 times more than you intended, but a day later, hey, we're seeing a sharp increase in your cost. You may want to take a look at those 5 metrics to see what's going on there. Totally. It would have saved me so much headache.
Yeah. I mean, that's where like sort of the real-time data collection and alerting becomes so important, right? I mean, with, you know, these traditional cloud cost tools, or even with AWS cost and usage reports directly, there is a way to enable, you know, hourly roll-ups. AWS, I don't believe it has very good, I mean, I've played around with their alerting and it's like pretty hard to use. Some of the cloud cost tools are a bit better. And so you can enable that hourly alerting, see the hourly alerts from those cloud cost tools. That doesn't necessarily help with drilling down to the root cause.
Exactly. They don't have drill down for, like, you either see hourly, which is nice, or you get the drill down. I couldn't find any way to get both at the same time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to solutions that can do it for me.
Yeah. Awesome.
Cool. I think we got all the good advice out of you. Anything I should be asking you and I forgot?
I think we're good. Yeah, I think that about covers it.
Fantastic. It was so good talking to you. So good to listen to your advice for startups and overview of the cost, cloud cost optimization space.
I really appreciate it. Yeah, great to be on, and thanks for all the questions.
Thank you so much for your time.